Today's talk is by Jared Clark, and you'll see the description in at the top of your order of service. What I am currently looking for on my lovely smartphone is the intro, which I neglected to bring with me, unfortunately. Jared is a teacher in Regina, perhaps I will ask you, rather than fumbling around here, I will ask you, Jared, if you would please come and share a little bit about yourself before we start the presentation.
I can just go, and I have a little bit of an intro anyways. Thank you, Joanne. Good morning, everybody. It's an honor to be here with you this morning to talk about climate change and to celebrate here. Like Joanne said, my name is Jared Clark. I'm a teacher. I live on a farm just outside of Edenwald, and with my wife and our two kids, twins, Rowan and Teal, who are six. And it's great to be here. I had the opportunity to travel to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in October of 2017, so last year, and participate with the Climate Reality Project. And it was a leadership training program. This is Al Gore's grassroots group organization that trains people in their communities trains people across the world and then sends them back into their communities to try and advocate for bold climate action. There were 1,400 people at this event, and from 32 different countries. So it was really quite fascinating to see. We learned from seven world-leading scientists in various disciplines about their research and how it relates to climate change and how they're seeing climate change and the different things that they do. So glaciers, forests, climate change in general, the Great Barrier Reef and coral reefs and those kind of things. So it's quite an experience. I come back to Saskatchewan with a real drive to talk about climate change and get us moving in the right direction here in Saskatchewan. Because I'm a bird watcher. I don't know. I knew Jim through my work at CJTR, where I host a radio show called The Prairie Naturalist. I've been doing it for 2.5 years now, and nature is an integral part of who I am. And scientists are telling us that in the next 80 years, by the end of this century, we could lose up to 50% of the species that call the Earth home. And that scares me a lot. And as a parent to 6-year-old kids, I look at the future of what scientists are telling us, and I'm motivated to act. So thank you again for the opportunity to be here. These are Mr. Gore's slides. As a climate leader, we get access to these, and we can use them and share them. And so I've taken, when we got this presentation from him, he talked for 2 hours and covered about 450 slides. Now, I'm not going to be doing that today. Don't worry. But these are a subsection that makes sense for a Saskatchewan audience. But he likes to start his presentations with these, and I do too. Or this picture. This is the blue marble. This is the first picture humans had of the Earth fully illuminated outside of our atmosphere, taken on Apollo 17 in 1972, I think. Oh yeah, 72. But this was interesting. Within a few months of this picture coming back, it changed humans' perspective on the Earth. So before, you know, you go outside and the Earth seems so big, and yet when you look at it like this, it's like just that little blue dot in this vast nothingness. And so things started to change. We saw the first, the beginning of the environmental movement on Earth. We saw things like Environmental Protection Agency in the United States come online because of this picture. People started to realize that the world isn't as limitless as we might think. So we're going to talk about three questions this morning. Must we change, can we change, and will we change? The first question that we will look at is, must we change? And the first thing when we're talking about climate change is to put things in perspective. So you go outside and the sky seems so big. Like, how could we possibly be having an impact on the atmosphere? But in reality, if we took my car and we drove it into the sky at highway speeds, we'd reach the end of the breathable atmosphere in 5 to 10 minutes. So it's really not that big, even though we perceive it to be. If I have a globe in my classroom, and it's the thickness of the veneer on the globe is relatively the thickness of the atmosphere to the Earth. So it's really not that big. And yet every day we are dumping about 110 million tons of man-made global warming pollution into the atmosphere. Now we'll go through the greenhouse effect really quickly. So we get radiation from the sun coming in. Most of that radiation is absorbed by the Earth and it warms it up. But some of that radiation bounces back in the form of infrared waves. But some of that energy, that infrared energy, is trapped by greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, and they keep that energy in the atmosphere. And it helps to warm the Earth a little bit, and this is a good thing. The greenhouse effect is a really good thing. It helps keep the Earth livable in the way we know it now. The problem is, though, is that as we burn those fossil fuels and add carbon dioxide and different greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we add more of that heat-trapping gas, and it's like adding a blanket to the Earth. And so globally, temperatures go up. Now, we know that there are a number of sources for greenhouse gas emissions, so air transportation, forest fires, landfills, industrial agriculture, coal power plants, but the number one largest source of greenhouse gases is the burning of fossil fuels. And this graph shows us the billions of metric tons of carbon that we have burned since the 1850s. And you can see that in 2016, we were burning about 10 billion metric tons. Now, we can see the implications or the results of this in global temperatures, global surface temperatures. This data comes from NASA and a number of other satellites that are collecting this data. But you can see the 0 degrees here is the average temperature from 1910 to 2000. And so if we saw no real change, if everything kind of stayed around the average, we would see the whole graph look like this. But as you can see, since the 1910s, globally, temperatures have been rising. 17 of the 18 hottest years have occurred since the year 2001. And the hottest four have all been the last 4 years. And we're seeing the implications of this across the globe as there are increasing heat waves. We saw this in Montreal and Quebec in July of this year, where 90 people died during the heat wave. But we also know that 93% of the extra heat being trapped within the atmosphere is actually going into the oceans. And we can see this by, again, ocean temperatures, data that's coming from various sources. But we see that temperatures are undeniably rising, and 2017 was the hottest year on record. So what does that mean? Well, there's two things that are happening when we have a warmer ocean. One, when there is more evaporation off of the ocean, and so we see more precipitation in the atmosphere. So when we get storms, there is more water in the storms, okay? The other thing is that there's more energy in these storms, so there's more heat in the system. And so when we get hurricanes or storm systems, they are more powerful than they would have been without climate change. So more precipitation in those storms, and the storms themselves have more energy. And we're seeing that. This is the city of Tacloban. Typhoon Haiyan went through in 2013. It resulted in 1.1 million homes being destroyed and 4.8 million climate refugees as a result. Typhoon Haiyan is one of the strongest storms on record in the southern hemisphere there, and traveled over waters that were significantly warmer than average. Again, this is not just happening in the east or in the Pacific Ocean. We're seeing this obviously in the Atlantic Ocean, the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricane Harvey did things we've never seen a hurricane do before. Hurricane Irma did things we've never seen a hurricane do. Even Michael and Florence just this year. So things are changing. But again, it's not just about hurricanes. It's also about precipitation that we get here in Saskatchewan. You notice over the last few decades that precipitation events are happening. We get more rainfall in these supercells. So this is a supercell in Glasgow, Montana in 2010. Now, interestingly, it's the same heat that's pulling water off of the ocean and evaporating more water into the atmosphere as is pulling moisture out of the land and causing longer and deeper droughts. And this should be familiar to us here in Saskatchewan. These were the drought conditions at the end of 2017. You can see that Regina, or just south of Regina, was not in a severe drought. It was not an extreme drought. It was in an exceptional drought. In fact, last year was the driest 17-month period on record since we started taking records for 130 years. And that does include the Dirty 30s. We also know that when we have warmer years, we have more forest fires. You can see there's a clear link between it's warmer, it's drier, we have more forest fires. And we're seeing that in California with campfires. We've also seen it in Fort McMurray. But we know if we look at worldwide weather catastrophes across the globe, they are undeniably increasing. And these are only climate-related events. So extreme temperatures, droughts, fires, floods, mudslides, storms. This does not include things like earthquakes and tsunamis, which are not climate related. And if you look at those on the graph, they have stayed constant over the last 30 years. But as you can see, 200 events in the 80s to over 700 in 2016. In 2016, there was $175 billion worth of loss. Only $50 billion of that was insured. And I like to say at this point that this is not some environmental greeny lefty group pushing their agenda with this data. This is actually from Munich Re, one of the world's largest reinsurance companies. And if you listen to the insurance companies, I've been hearing more and more in the media from them lately, is they are seeing this in their data. And they're talking, there's discussion around areas and people not being insurable in the future because of climate change. We can also look to the Arctic, where there's major shifts happening. This is 1993, 94, 2005, 2010, 2016. So here's 1984 to 2016. There's two things I want to draw your attention to here, just the vast amount of ice that is here. So the ice in the Arctic is really great at reflecting energy right out of the Earth back up into space, and then it doesn't impact us in any way. When we get rid of all that ice, this dark ocean doesn't reflect that energy anymore. It just absorbs it. And so we're seeing the Arctic warm faster than all the other regions of the Earth because in the summer, think about it, they get 24 hours of sunlight, right? The other thing that I like to draw your attention to is the dynamic of the ice in the Arctic. If we look at 1984, this is old ice, four-year-old ice or older, makes up a large proportion of the ice in the Arctic. Compared to 2016, the old ice has virtually disappeared. So it's certainly changing. We can also talk about melting ice sheets in Greenland, the Antarctic. And as these ice sheets that are on land melt, we see sea levels rising. And we are undeniably seeing that in places like Miami. This is in the streets of Miami, happening on a regular basis because of rising sea levels. This is not a flood. This is not a rain event. This is high tide. And this is happening regularly now. In fact, the city of Miami is spending millions of dollars to raise roads and install submersible pumps that run continuously to keep the water off of the roads. And if you talk to the mayor of Miami, who was a Republican, who has grown up in Miami, he will tell you that this never happened when he was a kid. These are the top 10 cities at risk from sea level rise by 2070 based on population. So Calcutta, Mumbai, all the way through Shanghai, Miami. This is the part that scares me the most. And so I hear people say, well, climate change, the climate has always changed. Why is this any different? And you're right. Climate has always changed. The climate does not have, we don't have this set that, oh, the earth must be this temperature and that is it and that's what we're keeping it at. No, it's always changed. The problem is that we have only lived on this earth on our climate that we currently live in for the last 10,000 years. And the way we live is very rigid. Our civilization is very rigid. If sea level goes up by 3 to 7 feet, as scientists are predicting it will by the end of this century, that's about half to a full billion people that currently live within that sea level rise. So half to a billion people will no longer be able to live or work where they currently live today. How do we deal with that? I mean, last year or 2 years ago when we were, the Syrian refugee crisis was happening and Canada pledged to bring in 25,000 refugees. I mean, that was, like, we were really, there was a lot of debate about that and it was a hard thing. Are we going to bring in that many people? And all of a sudden, I mean, we're talking about a billion people who possibly can't live where they currently live. Because our society, we can't move those cities. So, even the Department of Defense is taking this seriously. They're saying that climate change will likely lead to food and water shortages, pandemic diseases, disputes over refugees, and natural disasters in regions across the globe. I want to talk about two things real quick. Climate change is also a medical emergency. So those of you who get outside and go hiking in the summer are familiar with ticks, yes? So the ticks that we have here are wood ticks. The government of Saskatchewan has been testing ticks since 2008. About 26,000 ticks they've taken in and identified. The vast majority of those are wood ticks. These guys are black-legged ticks, and when they tested those ticks, only 64 of them were black-legged ticks. They've likely come in on birds. They kind of establish themselves for the summer, but then they'll die out during the winter, and it's not a big deal. They're not established here yet. However, with climate change, they are on the move and expected to be here because of warmer winters, and they can expand their range. So we are expecting them here by 2020. And you could be like, Jared, that's ridiculous. How can a tick get here? Well, if we look at Manitoba and just take a look here, Manitoba historically has never had black-legged ticks. Here are the areas, the high-risk areas for black-legged ticks in Manitoba as of last fall. The orangey circles. They are on our doorstep because of climate change. The other piece around the medical emergency piece is that mental health issues, what we've been hearing a lot about in Saskatchewan, we've been hearing a lot about in rural Saskatchewan, where I'm from. This is from a farmer out near Kindersley area. Meg Reynolds says, it's been a grim few years for her family watching drought and early snowstorms in turn obliterate their crops. Undeniably, the mental health crises that we are facing are in part being influenced by climate change, particularly in rural Saskatchewan for farmers and ranchers who very much their livelihood is impacted by weather. Like I mentioned off the top, we now risk losing up to 50% of all land-based species in this century. And so if we take all of the costs of climate change and we add them all up, at this point I always like to say it would be a lot more than what our government continues to tell us that will be the cost of a carbon tax. In fact, the World Economic Forum says that climate change is the number one threat to the economy. And so I would argue that all of those things will add up significantly more. So, must we change? I hope that I've convinced you that yes, we do. So the next question we need to talk about is, can we change? And this is, when I'm a teacher, and I talk to my students a lot about climate change. And in fact, we're doing an event on December 4th called the second annual Lakeview Community Climate Conversation. And so I teach my kids all about this, and I don't teach them about it because I want to scare them or because I want to give them anxiety or anything, but I teach them about the realities, but that I also teach them about hope, because this is what gives me hope. Can we change? And the answer is we have the solutions at hand today to solve the climate crisis. So let's talk briefly about wind power. So this is a 2000 projection. We'd reach 30 gigawatts by 2010. And the reality is that we exceeded that by 16 times in 2016. Global wind energy capacity is growing exponentially. These are megawatts on the side. And we can look to countries like Scotland, who are leading the charge here. They produced 100% of the country's electricity from wind in June of 2017. So things are coming along. These technologies are improving. But this is the exciting one for me in Saskatchewan, solar. By the year 2010, we were expected to get about 1 gigawatt per year development. And as you can see, we've exceeded that amazingly. World solar PV installations, photovoltaic installations are growing exponentially. These are gigawatts on the side. As the cost of these cells continue to drop. So the average production is now 28 cents per watt. Last year when I was doing these talks in 2017, it was 41 cents. So the technology continues to improve. The cost continues to drop. I can tell you that we have we have solar panels on our house. We installed them in the fall of 2016. In the last year, I have not paid a cent for electricity because we produce enough a ton of power during the summer, and we get credit for the extra power that we produce and put back on the grid, and then we ride out that credit over the winter when our production fades or decreases because of the sun. Our day lengths are shorter, and the sun is lower in the horizon or in the sky, so we don't get as much production. But we are actually saving a ton of money. We do have the initial upfront cost, which was $24,000, and then we got the 20% rebate, so about $19,000. We should get our return on investment in about 10 to 12 years, depending on electricity prices. So, and our panels are guaranteed for 25 and are expected to last for 40. So for 25 to 30 years, we will be just saving money because of it. So again, the economics of solar are really quite exciting, and we're seeing things like this. This is in South Sudan. This house has never had electricity been able to be provided to it, and yet the price is so low that they can get these solar panels and create electricity where they've never experienced that before. The Chilean solar market is really exciting too. 2013, 2014, the end of 2015, and this is what's being developed or is in has been approved for development. Yeah. Yeah. 13.3 gigawatts of power. So you can be a leader in this area. You can say we're going to transition, and it can be done. There are examples across the world. Even the Vatican is going solar. Because we know that enough sunlight reaches the earth in 1 hour. We get enough energy from that 1 hour of sunlight to fill the world's energy needs for the full year. So we can, there is a ton of potential here to harvest this power. These are the auto manufacturers that are moving to electric vehicles, which is virtually all of them, places around the world. Switzerland has said that by next year, 2019, you'll no longer be able to sell a gasoline combustible engine. It has to be hybrid or electric. So can we change? I think the answer is certainly yes. The question is, will we change? This is the one that's a little more up in the air. We do have the Paris Agreement from 2015, where every nation signed on to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions. So we have this. Canada agreed to this. We have these emissions. Does the Paris Agreement go far enough? No, but it's a start, and we can ramp up as we need. But Canada agreed to this. We need to hold our politicians' feet to the fire. I don't really care who you vote for, but every politician has to be hearing from its constituents that this is a threat. you're concerned about this and you want real climate action, right? And people are doing that. This is the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C., where hundreds of thousands of people stood up and said, enough is enough, let's deal with this, because this is a problem. Because this is it. This tiny little blue dot, as you know, is all we have. And so, you know, in 20 years, when my kids are starting their own family or they're starting their careers or whatever, and they ask me, Dad, what did you do? You knew what the scientists were telling you. You knew what the scientists were screaming at you. What did you do to solve the climate crisis? And I want to be able to say that I did everything that I possibly could. And so I'll turn the question to you. What will you be able to tell your children or your grandchildren about what you did when you knew what was happening? Thank you. Now, I have a brand new video that my class just produced with Stephen Hall, who's a—I don't know—some of you may know Stephen from around here, but I don't know—I don't know how much time I've used, and I don't know if I need to sit down. But it's a four-minute video. If we can take some questions or whatever, or if I'll just show it and then I'll stop talking, or I'll just stop talking now. It's whatever the congregation wants.
I think we want to hear the video,
okay.
See the video.
I'm really excited about this. So this is. My class partnered with Stephen Hall. He's a local film producer. And we filmed this in the middle of October, and we just released it on Friday morning at our school. We had a screening for the documentary. It's a mini doc.
What grade do you teach?
Grade 6-7. So this is our...
It's hard to make a change. You can't have it happen like that. You have to convince people and have people on your side.
So this is what we think we know about solar power.
It's a renewable energy.
The power is from the sun's UV rays,
and it's a solution for climate change.
Well, climate change is a serious thing, and it's happening
when we burn coal or use fossil fuels.
They produce lots of greenhouse gases.
And it's like they're adding blankets to the atmosphere, which is keeping all the heat in.
So if we look at this graph, we see that 40% of our electricity comes from coal, 35% from natural gas.
We looked at a graph, and solar wasn't even on it for what kind of power we used here in Saskatchewan.
And then one is other. So does anybody see solar on our pie graph right now?
No.
No.
Like less than 1% of Saskatchewan is solar.
I want you to open up the atlas to a map of Canada.
The map that we talked about in class shows how much solar energy is hitting certain regions of Canada.
Best place to get solar is probably... right here.
Regina.
Obviously, a lot of people haven't seen this. We live down in the southern part of Saskatchewan, and as you can see on the map, there's a lot of red. And where there's a lot of red, we can produce a lot of solar energy, and we get a lot of sunlight, whereas where it's blue, it's not.
So do we have a lot of solar in Regina?
No. We barely have any, like, solar parks or panels.
Why?
I don't know why. We should, but we just don't. And we should obviously have more, because we have the most potential kilowatt hours in Canada.
I'm a big proponent of experiential learning, where kids get hands-on experience or get to see things up close, getting outside.
Culture could provide us with the energy that's required in not only for ourselves, but for all of Canada, all of the universe.
So to our understanding, this is the only utility-scale wind, solar, and battery storage project in Canada. So it's the first of its kind.
Getting out to houses and seeing the install up close was incredible.
wind turbine was way bigger than I thought it would be.
If you have the batteries, it stores the energy that you create during the day, so you can use it at night.
The reason we invested our own money into this project is because the power that comes from this site, we sell it.
I think it's important for the kids to understand that there's an economic side, because the economics is what's going to drive renewable energy.
And the money that we made from the wind turbine and the batteries, we actually saved that all up, and we use it to put towards the solar panels. So do you guys want to go look at the solar panels now? Okay, let's head over.
When I saw them, I was like, holy, that's a lot of solar panels.
Well, I've never seen anything like that before.
It was cool, though, because, like, there's a lot of solar panels.
And in a year, they would produce 560,000 kilowatt hours.
So thank you. That we're really excited about that. But anyways, I'll hand it back to you, Joanne.
Thanks very much, Jared. You've just fulfilled one of our other objectives, which is to learn about Indigenous success stories, and to be doing it with an environmental positive story is even better.
The Cowessess Renewable Energy Facility is actually just on the outskirts of Regina, so it's not at the Cowessess Reserve. It's on their land, just real close. So the Cinder Creek Building on the way on the number one going towards White City, that the wind turbine is right south of there, so like a mile south, and so that facility is right there. So this is right on the edge of Regina. Cowessess is leading the way in terms of what the future could look like in terms of renewable energy. So we got to go out the day they opened up the solar panels, because those are brand new. So we were there on the opening day. It was really quite an experience for me and the kids. So
that's
thank
great.
You.